like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Scott Blaze, CEO and co-founder of the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, whose initial facility is the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil. Elephant Sanctuary Brazil was created to provide a safe, sprawling home across 2,800 acres for captive elephants who had previously lived in zoos and or lived in circuses. This was in anticipation of a ban on performing elephants passing in Brazil, joining five other South American countries that already had outlawed performing elephants. I spoke in 2013 with Scott, who had previously co-founded the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee. And in that earlier conversation, the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil was still taking shape. Scott outlined hopes and goals and a vision for that sanctuary. It has seen considerable activity recently, with two elephants having been relocated there just in the past several weeks. Efforts are underway to give home to a third, and I get the impression there's even more action on the horizon. So it feels like a good time to check in with Scott and get caught up on all this, which we'll do in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll speak with Kelsey Eberle, staff attorney with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, about a lawsuit ALDF filed to help remove horses from California Equine Retirement Foundation, or CERF, which has been around for some 30 years accepting donations with the premise that they'll rehabilitate horses and provide them sanctuary for the rest of their lives. Lately, it turns out some of the horses have apparently been neglected and severely underfed, among other problems. Found this absolutely dreadful, a powerful story, both for the situation itself and for the broader implications, as a cautionary tale. So we'll touch on that with Kelsey Eberle a bit later in the program. Right now, let's get to our conversation with Scott, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Scott Blaze via Skype from Brazil on Talking Animals on WMNF.
How are you?
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great, great, great. Great to have you back on Talking Animals. And we have so many things we want to try to cover. Of course, want to get into a few other things before the news and updates in Brazil, because one of the things that occurred to me just as we were preparing for this show, and I posted something the other night about our forthcoming conversation, and people went bonkers on social media. I mean, which is a measure of how long you've been doing it and how people, of course, love and respect the work that you've done. But it also seems like it's at least partly about their passionate feelings for elephants. So I guess in a way I'd kind of like to start as sort of something of a prelude for our conversation to ask you, as a guy who's worked with elephants for some 30 years, what makes them magical? What inspires that kind of response in people?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question, Duncan.
Yeah.
I actually didn't realize that it was 2013 since we last talked, and indeed a lot has transpired since then, in great part thanks to the magic that everybody is attracted to about elephants and the great passion around the world that allows our work to take place. For me, it's a near impossibility. It's something that people have asked for many years, and I never have a good answer. There is just something unique and special and incredible about elephants in general, and also even more so about each individual. I think people are compelled to their story, their journey through chaos to get to the sanctuary. And when they arrive here, they just seem to flip a switch, and everything seems to just start off like, okay, it's a new day, it's a new time, and, you know, it's a new life before us. So they're just, it's intangible. It's something that is undefinable to me to define exactly, to put into words exactly what it is. They're astounding, they're amazing, they're incredible, they're magical, They're just amazing all the way around.
Well, they certainly strike a chord clearly with people, and I count myself amongst them. I mean, I've found them magical for some years, and in all kinds of ways. Like you say, some of it's hard to define. Some of it's just the way they function in families, the way they grieve and show other kind of more sophisticated emotional feelings than at least some animals, and just countless stories that you hear about elephants, both in the wild in many cases. Is in captivity, and you just think, wow, these are extraordinary beings.
They really are. And you know, this family dynamic and their ability to grieve, or their sensitivity to those that have passed, their mourning of bones that of deceased elephants that they pass on their journey. I mean, all these things are absolutely intriguing and in some ways mind-boggling how they know and how they perceive. But I do believe it goes to a much deeper level of, and you said it, you know, in your introduction about them, the magic of who they are. With magic, there's an intangibility that is impossible to define. So all those elements tie in, but there's something more. Something more about them that is just, it's awe-inspiring. It's just, it is magical.
Yeah. No, and again, it's just one measure of that. Like I say, I posted this thing a couple nights ago. And as I say, I mean, people went bonkers, tons of stuff, of course, about you and, you know, sharing this thing left and right. And just, I think, because you've been doing it so long, and of course, people know you from the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, and then your recent efforts in Brazil, and just overall, I just think, in the same way that elephants strike a particular chord, I think you, obviously, you strike a particular chord, too. So I won't be surprised if we, by email or phone or whatever, hear from some folks when they realize... there might be a chance to speak with Scott Blaze on the show, as we do some speaking ourselves. But yeah, so we did last speak in 2013 at full length. I mean, we have spoken since then in brief interview, and we've done other interviews over the years, including one time I think you were on a panel that when I used to do an annual show sort of tied to Ringling coming through town, we did you were part of that panel. So anyways, we've talked a number of times, but the last time we really spoke at length, at least about Elephant Sanctuary Brazil, it was still taking shape. You had outlined your kind of hopes and goals for the sanctuary, and you really created a vision really for what you hoped it would become. So I know a lot has happened in the ensuing years. Heck, I think a lot has happened in the last few weeks over there from what I can gather. So it might be helpful in a way though for today's conversation to just briefly review what the Global Sanctuary for Elephants is and what the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil represents in sort of under that umbrella.
Okay, great. Yeah, a lot has definitely transpired here in Brazil. In 2013, we co-founded, it was myself, my wife, Kat Blaze, along with Joyce Poole and Peter Granley from Elephant Voices, and one of the former employees of the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, got together with some folks in Brazil to develop a global sanctuary for elephants with the concept of trying to help develop solutions for elephants around the world. And I say solutions because there's a lot of progressive change. There's a lot of things happening. There's a lot of great movement. There's a lot of awareness that is growing, and with that awareness, people are taking action and creating legislation that is preventing animals from performing or removing elephants from difficult situations. But that's only half the story. You know, the progressive actions need a solution, and without the solution, these elephants continue to be compromised. And that was what's happening here in South America, and the reason why we focused on South America as our first project, our first international project, is because of the growing legislation, and without a solution, elephants were being sequestered from the circus, or taken from the circus and sequestered and isolated into rural farms. Some of them stuck on chains, others being moved to zoos that didn't have any facilities at all and didn't have any level of adequate care. And that we exist to create the solutions, to create that alternative, create a life for these elephants where they can get the care, the nurturing, the space, the autonomy, the friendship, the social environment that they need to fully recover and thrive as elephants should always have done. It's a challenge here. Since 2013, we had a lot of difficulty in finding the property, in part because of the lack of documentation in a lot of rural lands where the climate is ideal. It is considered, in some ways, still the frontier. It has only been established for, you know, not too terribly long. When we're up in the north of the state that we're in right now, Mato Grosso, and there were many lands that were available, but few had proper documentation. And while people said, no problem, no problem, we always said that's a huge problem not to have proper documentation. This is going to be running up donations. nations. It's going to be, you know, taking elephants for life. We can't afford to have conflict down the road. So we actually relocated a little bit further south in our search in the state of Mato Grosso, close to the state capital of Cuiabá. And it's in a beautiful region. We found an idyllic 2,800 acres. It was owner financed, which was brilliant because of the status that we were in the beginning. He also helped to secure, you know, to secure this 2,800 acres. He actually purchased three additional farms and then bundled them and sold all of them, all four properties to us. And it really is idyllic.
Wow.
When Peter Granley was here from Joyce from Elephant Voices, he said people just need to come here. You know, when you come here, you see the future for captive elephants, and it really is remarkable land that is the foundation of all of it.
So, Scott, just with the acquiring and sort of putting that big parcel of land together, was that just some great fan and sort of angel who did that and then sort of handed off the land to you guys?
Well, we're purchasing the land from him.
I see. Okay,
it is an owner finance. We are purchasing the land. We're not done with the payments yet.
Okay.
But we have, he was very, very helpful.
Great.
Here in South America, it's almost impossible to get loans as a nonprofit organization and without having a full financial backer to support the loan if for some reason the organization would fault. And as a new organization in South America, and at that point, Global Sanctuary Elephants was also a very new organization, we didn't have the support. We didn't have that type of backing. So we really were dependent on owner financing deal, and this guy came really out of nowhere, and it was a land that I had already looked at online. I looked at it twice before he came to visit with us, and he said, I want to help you make it work. And
wow.
Here we are. You know, it was really the story of all of it, going back to the sanctuary in Tennessee, starting with a dream and a vision to give more to elephants. And then once you start take that first step forward, once you start putting in that positive action into progress and building momentum, people start coming from everywhere to support. And it really is humbling. I heard your introduction, and it really is humbling to hear the kind words of support, to get the support that we have internationally to carry this project forward in all projects. You actually said in the introduction also about another organization that wasn't using their money properly. It wasn't providing care for these animals, and it is tragic. It's tragic for the animals. It's tragic in the bigger picture. We all have to work, and we all have to devote ourselves to doing the greater good and really honoring everybody that is involved. You know, we get a lot of accolades, but we're doing this and we're only here because of the support that we get internationally. And to define a little bit more of how we feel about that, one of our caregivers said to me the other day, I was talking about a fundraising campaign we have going on right now. And she said, it really is amazing, you know, how people come from all around the world to support. And she said, but also with that, there's a lot of responsibility, you know, and just the weight of the responsibility to make sure we are honoring the gifts that are given to this project is a lot. But it's also why we're here, because we do honor every gift. And why I think people do trust us is because we've proven over the years, you know, the integrity of the organization and the transparency. But our caregiver, Shirley, just said it perfectly. It is a lot of responsibility to the elephants, to the donors, and to the greater good.
Well, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Scott Blaze, co-founder of the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, whose initial facility is the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil, where there's been considerable activity lately, including two new elephants relocating there with another very possibly on the way. Scott is speaking to us via Skype from Brazil. And if you'd like to ask him a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. In fact, we've already got one caller that's been holding a while. Let's get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Scott Blaze.
Hey, thank you, Duncan, as always, for bringing extremely interesting things to the world. And thank you, Scott, for caring. You know, with Bolsonaro, who seems to hate the environment, native species, indigenous peoples, and ecosystems in general, what is it like there now to try and do anything conservation-related? And my other question is that, given population growth and development, isn't it possible that the elephant's native range is just going to be destroyed by development, population growth, and climate change, so that free-ranging elephants within 10 to 20 years might just disappear off the planet?
Yeah, good questions, both of them. To break it down on the regarding the President Bolsonaro, it is interesting. Of course, the political climate is, you know, scary to some, and others are celebrating, you know, just as it is in most of the world. You have the full spectrum of supporters and haters, I guess. For us as a nonprofit organization, what we are seeing is a public, a population that is looking for something positive. They're looking for something good to support. And we're able to provide that for the elephants. We're able to provide a better life, and with that, open minds and hearts to the greater good, and to the our responsibility as a whole to look after the environment, look after the animals, look after, you know, the community. It is all part of it. And when you look at the overall cultural dynamic in Brazil, it is challenging right now. But at the same time, as the microclimate, if you want to call it that, of the culture around us, we have a lot of support. We have a lot of intrigue. We are in an area that is very conservation-minded. It's near a national park, relatively close to a national park. And so we have a lot of folks that are just really of like mind, of similar mind to our organization. So with that, we get a lot of social support and community support within the specific region. That's not the case everywhere in Brazil. There are a lot of challenges, and you know, we could talk for hours just about that. But it is, I think it is that global crisis of lack of proper conservation efforts. And then you talk about, I shouldn't say lack of conservation. There's a lot of conservation efforts, but there's also a lot of pushback from some of the global leaders that are not allowing the good to take place. We're not having a challenge against that for our particular project, but as a whole and a global level, it is definitely a challenge. Sorry, I just lost track of your second question.
The native range
population
being
growth.
Yeah.
You know, when we started this project, one of the things we looked at is there an opportunity to return elephants back to home ranges where they could have sanctuary settings, you know, in a truly natural habitat? But that has a lot of challenges in itself. And one of those is the population growth. One it is the number of elephants that are in crisis in home ranges is substantial. And if, you know, if you're going to develop sanctuaries in home ranges, those have to go towards those elephants that are crisis within those regions, and we felt it was best suited to build a sanctuary here for elephants in South America to take care of them the rest of their life. But again, on the global level, the bigger picture, absolutely, if we don't find a solution to our to the growing crisis that humans are creating, elephants and many other species are looking at a catastrophic demise, and we have to take positive action now. And this is what we are trying to do. You know, I think we all have to do our part, and this is where we can focus, because we have a lot of history with captive elephant recovery, helping them recover from the trauma and the stress, and I think trauma is the best of the deep-seated trauma that can take years for them to fully rebound. And this is where we can best make our difference, while other folks are making difference in another part of the world. Ultimately, we're all working on the same goal, is to make their life better.
And Scott, our caller sort of alluded to the political climate, and you already had noted the actual weather climate is ideal there in Brazil. A friend, we were chatting a little bit about last night about the conversation that you and I are going to be having this morning, and he asked, what are the actual climate requirements for providing elephants a good, comfortable home? Like, how cold can it be, and more to the point, can it not be for this to work?
Yeah, when you're looking at captive elephant care, you have to consider, you know, both the weather extremes, the extreme hot and extreme cold. And basically, you can put elephants almost anywhere that has moderate climate, like we did in Tennessee, with the sanctuary in Tennessee. But in those climates where they do have colder winters, you have to build substantial winter enclosures, barns where they can come into the winter. Most days they were still able to go outside in the winter, but they still had spent most of the nights inside the barn from November to March. Here where we are, we don't have to worry about that. The climate is truly idyllic. It is we very, very rarely drop below 50 degrees. It may touch 45 degrees one night a year. And then it very rarely gets above 95 degrees.
Wow.
So we're really right in the middle of what would be a normal home range, a normal climactic range for Asian and African elephants.
Yeah.
And with that, we don't have to build these substantial structures that not only cost a lot of money to construct, but also for the ongoing maintenance, cleaning, husbandry.
Sure.
So really what ends up happening is it ends up being perfect for elephants and reduces our overall construction and operating costs.
Well, as a brief tangent, Scott, but sort of related to cold weather, or at least that into the extreme and elephants, I noticed one of the many, many comments that again poured in after I posted about our conversation that came up was wondering if I would ask ask you about your view on whether Lucy, the elephant who lives alone in the Edmonton Valley Zoo, should be moved to a sanctuary or elsewhere. So it may be important to note that I think last summer, ZooCheck Canada warned Lucy supporters and activists that Lucy may now be too ill and frail to move. And then just even last night, just in sort of final preparation for this, I saw something online that I don't think the specifics have been released, but it sounds like there is some new veterinary reports about Lucy, which seem to suggest some not great news. So anyway, if you have just any overall view on that, just again, because that's a lone elephant slash weather issue that maybe people would like to hear your view on.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation up there right now. You know, we had a situation, I'll touch base on Lucy in a second, but to put perspective outside of that, the emotional struggle that is, with everybody talking about Lucy, we were working with an elephant named Palusa, who had catastrophic foot infections, and she was in Argentina, and we were trying to get her to the sanctuary. And it was the first time that I said to Kat, my wife, and I said, I'm not sure we should move her. And she said, you've never given up on an elephant before. Mm-hmm. And she's right, I hadn't, but I was fearful of what might happen if she doesn't make it. And unfortunately, that fear ends up driving too many decisions. Ultimately, what we ended up doing with Palusa is saying, our goal is to get her to the sanctuary. Every day we will reassess, but our goal is to get her to the sanctuary. And we were moving in that direction, even though we knew it was going to be a challenge. Tragically, she passed away before she had that opportunity to be moved. She was about 6 weeks away from being moved before when she passed away. But we always have to aim for the greatest objective, the greatest possible solution for these animals. And unfortunately, we sell these elephants out because we always come up with a reason why they shouldn't be moved. And zoos are always pushing back. They love their family. She won't know how to adjust. She doesn't know how to live in a natural environment. She won't know how to feed herself. I mean, these are all arguments that we've heard for years. She'll die in transport. These simply are fear-based presumptions that really have no substance to them at all. And that's what happened with Lucy. I mean, they've been fighting for Lucy's release for years, and they've been saying, well, she may not live more than a couple of years, it's not worth it. Well, I think we're 8 or 10 years into the battle with Lucy, and she's still alive. She had an opportunity, and the zoo held her back. The society held her back, and we have to stop selling short what these elephants are capable of doing. So can Lucy travel in this moment? I can't say. Yeah. I don't know well enough. But I would still be pushing for that ultimate solution to give her a life that she deserves. And the way we've said it, with even with Ramba, who recently arrived from Chile, when we went to go pick her up, she was quite weak. She was not looking very good. And we kept true to what we've always said, was if it's 10 days, 10 weeks, or 10 years, sanctuary is still magical for them. And it does. The transition starts right away. As soon as she stepped off that elephant transport container, everyone said, who is this elephant? And the next day, less than 12 hours after she arrived, one of the film crews who was with us in Chile said, how is this possible? She looks like a completely different individual this morning. There's a different radiance about her. And all she did was step out of the elephant transport container and spent the night inside the elephant in the elephant care center. Mm-hmm. She hadn't even explored. And it really starts right away. There's a different vibe. There's a different energy. There's a different force that exists in the sanctuary. And I think all elephants deserve a chance to feel that, including Lucy.
Well, it sounds like if, as we said earlier in the conversation, if elephants themselves are sort of magical, the transformative powers of a captive elephant going to a sanctuary like this one now in Brazil and others, obviously, itself can be magical.
It's incredible. Yeah. It is. It almost puts tears in my eyes. It's really incredible, Duncan. I've been doing this for a long time. Yeah. I've watched a lot of elephants transition, and it is absolutely mind-boggling still to this day how an elephant arrives after 4 or 5 days of ground transport. With Ramba, she had a flight from Chile to Brazil and then 3 days of travel. How they step out of that transport container and just look so radiant, and how they just seamlessly adapt it's mind-boggling. It is, again, going back to the beginning of the conversation, it's undefinable. It's intangible.
Well, again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Scott Blaze, co-founder of the Global Sanctuary for Elephants. He was also the co-founder of the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee, and we're discussing the facilities overseeing now, the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil, and the elephants who live there. If you'd like to join this conversation with Scott, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So you mentioned Ramba a couple of times. Let's run down the elephant population there in Brazil, which has changed significantly in recent weeks, including Ramba. But let's start with the first residents. Maybe briefly hear their names and stories before they arrived at the Brazil sanctuary, and then we'll meet the newest residents.
Okay, since we are short on time, I'll try to go through this quickly because sure. I can talk for hours about these beautiful beings, these beautiful spirits. But the first two that came were Maya and Gita. And going back to what we talked about before, you know, they were removed from the circus. They didn't have anywhere to go. The owner for the circus moved them to his property, and they were stuck on chains. Maya and Gita were chained separate from one another because Maya was always aggressive to Gita and pretty brutally aggressive. She would push her down and then, you know, continue to beat up on her. She was pretty brutal to her. They arrived at the end of 2016, and Gita was quite a bit skinnier than Maya. Maya was big body, big personality. And when about 12 hours after they arrived, 18 hours after they arrived, we opened up the gate between them, and they just seemed to be totally okay. We opened up for them to go explore outside, and they started grazing and wandering. And we only had one small yard at that point because we were just in the early stages of construction. And they just really just melded into the environment seamlessly, not only into the environment, but together. After 40 years of living together and never getting along, they were completely without restriction together for within 12 hours, 18 hours after arrival. And from that point forward, they were always remarkable. Maya had a lot to learn. Maya had to learn to be respectful. And Gita taught her that in the wonderful way that elephants do, through passive encouragement. And what she would happen is Maya was very displacing of Gita. She would come over and she would steal her food. Hmm. And Gita said, fine, I can just walk away. And Maya was left there, was like, but I want to be with you. And Gita's like, no, you want to steal my food. You don't want to be with me. You know. And then this would happen over and over again. And then Maya started realizing that if she wanted to be a friend, she actually had to respect her friend. And you started to see this evolution of friendship. And then Gita started coming out of her shell more. And as Maya, that big personality, was actually hiding a huge insecurity that's inside of Maya. So she started resolving that insecurity and actually started feeling better about herself and more confident about who she was. She wasn't being as displacing anymore. She wasn't being as pushy. And Gita, on the other hand, started becoming very soft and rumbly. And we nicknamed her Sweet Rumbles because she would take three steps and rumble. And rumbling is like a soft purr. It's like a very gentle, very content sound. And it can mean multiple different things, but in this situation, that's what it was. And she was rumbling all of the time. And as each yard expanded, as they grew together, and as we expanded the facilities, Gita would rumble more. Maya and Gita would come closer together. And then towards the end, actually, Gita passed away not too long ago, earlier this year, I think in June. When Gita passed away, Maya and Gita were the best of friends. They were together all day long. They were calling each other to locate each other throughout the habitat. They were standing over top of each other to protect one another when they slept. It just became this beautiful, beautiful, amazing friendship of pure joy and love and admiration and appreciation for one another. The difficulty with that is when she did pass away, it really took its toll on Maya.
I'm sure.
It was really, really hard. But then we go back to that scenario that we talk about with humans all the time. Do you restrain yourself from loving someone because it's going to hurt? Or do you allow yourself to love knowing that it might hurt? And I would absolutely give these elephants an opportunity to feel that level of joy and love that she hadn't felt in 40 years of living together.
Yeah.
Same two elephants, same lives, different environment, and their relationship completely transformed. But Maya grew phenomenally through that. Gita grew phenomenally through that. And with Gita's tragic passing, it left a big hole for Maya. And now, after several months, she's opening up more. She's a little brighter each day. She's smiling more. She's not fully ready to let another elephant in on that same level, but she is growing and evolving each day and finding that joy in life again. But it really was a beautiful, you know, ended in tragedy, but it was a beautiful relationship to observe.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, again, we want to be sure to we hit the newest residents and some other things, and there's another caller here. But if we had more time, and maybe we'll come back to this for another conversation at another time, but I'm super intrigued, and again, only someone that's probably worked with elephants for 30 years or so could do this, but just the thing you said about Maya not quite being ready to let another elephant into her life, and just how you make that assessment, I guess that's just from years and years of experience and just watching elephants and what they signal and how they react to things and don't react to things. And I guess you just sort of make that conclusion. And I guess along those lines, at a certain point, there'll be probably a different indication from her that
right.
I am ready.
Yeah, and we don't always know. And that's one of the difficult things to teach new people. We have a very long training process with new folks, new caregivers, because there's so many nuances to understand and so many nuances to watch. And it's hard to pull yourself away from, wow, it's amazing being close to them, to really step back and assessing those nuances. And we don't always know what's going on. We don't always have the answers. And Kat and I talk extensively. And it's one of the beautiful things about what we're able to do is share this life together and be able to bounce these ideas back and forth. What do you think Maya's feeling? What do you think this is about? And we always keep an open mind. So while we make an assessment, we always know that assessment could be wrong. So we don't pigeonhole into that. We always keep that door open for them to show us what is new or show us something more that will help us further define for us what it is that's going on. So it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's really got to be nuanced, but it's also, again, I've been doing this for a long time, but it's always each day in each new elephant is something, we learn something new from them. And with our newest resident lady, we also have Hannah who came here. She was also from Circus, sent to a small zoo, didn't get proper care. The zoo sent her to us. Ramba, who we already talked about,
yeah.
Confiscated from the circus. We removed her from the circus back in 2012. She was at a safari park waiting for sanctuary until now.
Yeah.
She arrived in October 18th approximately. And then Lady just arrived just a couple of weeks ago. Same sort of scenario. She was actually captive born in the United States, sold to a circus. Traveled on circus, removed from the circus, sent to a small zoo. They didn't know how to properly care for her, and she just arrived. And she has catastrophic foot ailments. Foot infections is one of the leading causes of death in captivity, death for elephants in captivity.
Yeah.
And she's really fearful. She's actually afraid of other elephants. She's afraid of new people.
Mm.
She's very, very insecure. So it's going to be a challenge with her to help her find that confidence. But it's just about giving them time, respect, and giving them the reassurance that it is their time, it's their space, and they get to lead us through the journey that they need for their recovery.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take another caller, and I certainly have more questions after that. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Scott Blaze. Hello, go ahead, it's you.
Oh. Hello?
Hello, it's you. You have a question or comment for Scott?
Oh, yes, Scott. This is Alana. I'm Hannah's aunt, I think, and I loved the thing in the pond yesterday. Is that standing over her a natural behavior to connect?
I think you're talking about the standing over top of her in the pond. And actually it is Hannah standing over top of Ramba, and we see this a lot. I talked about it with my Angita a few minutes ago, that they stand over each other to protect each other when they lay down. And it is a very nurturing environment, a nurturing behavior. For those that have followed the sanctuary in Tennessee, you remember from Shirley and Jenny when they reunited, Shirley would stand over Jenny when Jenny was sleeping in the habitat. Maya would stand over Gita. Gita would stand over Maya, kind of protect each other when they're sleeping. And that's all it is. And one of the interesting things with that is the transition with Hannah. When she first came and Maya and Gita started to lay down, Hannah's like, what are you doing laying down? You can't lay down. And she would almost wake them up right away. And Maya and Gita's like, but we want to take a nap. But Hannah didn't really know what to do in that environment because they haven't been given an opportunity to be nurturing to another elephant, especially in captivity. In circus elephants where they're on chain, they haven't had that opportunity very much. Some of them not at all. So now as Hannah is evolving and transforming, and now she has this beautiful friendship with Ramba, and she's very nurturing and protective of Ramba. So when Ramba did lay down in the pond, then Hannah went over to do that nurturing, protecting thing to stand over top of her. She wasn't squishing her. She wasn't sitting on her. You could see she was being very gentle and very definitive, very intentional with where she's putting her legs. As she maneuvered around her body, and then when Ramba showed that she was ready to get up, Hannah then moved away at the same time. So you can see it's very nurturing, very protective behavior.
Right. It seems to be typical also when a calf is born that they get amazingly close without stepping on them.
They're amazing. You know, people talk about their size and how, you know, how they think that they're clumsy. They think that they are you know, they would step on things all the time, or they'd, you know, possibly hurt other animals. You know, we have the dogs and the chickens and the roosters around here. They're amazing. They are so intentional with almost every movement. Sometimes you're going to get somebody that responds to being startled or something like this, where you're going to get an atypical movement. But most of the time, they're very intentional with everything that they're doing and very specific. And their delicacy for their size is just again, it's astounding. It's amazing to watch.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. We got to move on. We're running short on time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do want to say that, speaking of these elephants that we've gotten a little bit of a quick overview of, there's a number of reasons to visit the website globalelephants.org, but among them is that each elephant resident has kind of a fact sheet with the birth or rebirth day date, I guess, observations about their personality, their health, their history, and more, which is really cool and fascinating. So, and I guess in a way, this sort of brings us to, so far, those are all Asian elephants, correct, Scott?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right now, we have capacity for 10 female Asian elephants, and then we have to continue to expand to open their space. And we're in the process of building for African elephants, which is our next big push that we're working on right now. We have a fundraising campaign going on right now for Kenya. She is an elephant that is in the Mendoza, Eco Park Mendoza, formerly known as Mendoza Zoo. We actually have, they have four elephants that are there. We expect our two female Asians to come, hopefully within the first quarter of the new year. And then as soon as we're ready for Africans, for Kenya, we'll be able to receive Kenya. And then we also have to construct for male Asians, because they have a male Asian as well named Tammy. And that actually is the full story there, is they're transforming from the zoo to an eco park. And part of that is placing animals, every animal possible, into sanctuaries that are more suited to care for these animals in whatever species. I think they just sent 10 bears to the United States to a sanctuary. They've sent some cats overseas also to another sanctuary. So they're doing great work. And this is just where it all ties in together, the social change as well as a solution. And then, of course, people come to support and donate to the fundraisers that make our growth and our development possible, which makes the new life for these elephants possible as well.
And Scott, for those listening who may not fully appreciate the differences, maybe you could just outline either some key differences between Asian and elephant Africans, or at least why they're not housed together.
Right. You know, we jokingly say the similarities are four legs and a trunk. But they're so vastly different. They're both highly intelligent. They're both highly social. You know, they both are elephants. But when you get into the nuances of their behavior, it's completely different. African elephants are much higher energy. They much more reactionary in many ways. And Asian elephants are much more pensive. And that's not to say that African elephants aren't pensive, but they seem to react first and then think later. And let me add the caveat of this is what I've seen with captive elephants. I haven't had an opportunity to study both African and Asian and African elephants in the wild.
Sure.
But in captivity, this is what we see. And, you know, with Asian elephants, they're much more pensive and they're a little bit more placid when they play. They're a little bit more sweet and tender. African elephants, when they play, they're much more rough and tumble. And that same, those behavior patterns, those nuances can actually cause a conflict because of miscommunication. A simple action of an African elephant saying, hey, let's play, that same action could and often means aggression in Asian elephants. So the Asian elephant saying, no, I don't want to fight. And the African saying, no, let's just play. And there can be confusion that can actually create antagonistic or aggressive action because of the confusion. So we feel that it's best to try to give them like species, keep Africans with Africans, Asians and Asians. No, we are not segregationist. We are just looking at the core nature of the species and what they need for recovery, especially elephants. When we talk about lady being so intimidated and nervous and not really knowing what to do around other elephants, imagine you add to that the flamboyance of an African elephant, which is even more intimidating, and the flapping of the ears, which is really dramatic, and they're much more dramatic, and so that can be even more intimidating, especially an elephant like Lady that needs more time, that needs more peace, and needs a little bit more subtlety in order for her to recover.
Right. So part of that kind of keep those separate is that, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that kind of needs to be squared away, and I guess funding is still sort of pending for that, is fencing so that Kenya, for example, who it sounds like would be the first African there, would have, again, a separate but equal place to roam, but again, to make sure that the Asians and the Africans did maintain their kind of a respectful distance. So I guess that's in some ways brings me to, how is the sanctuary operation funded?
Yeah, I didn't touch base on this properly at the beginning. We are actually two different organizations. We're Global Sanctuary for Elephants, and we work hand-in-hand with Elephant Sanctuary Brazil. Mm. Elephant Sanctuary Brazil is a Brazilian-based nonprofit organization, and we work in full collaboration. We are here, my wife and I are here, to oversee the development and operations of Elephant Sanctuary Brazil while they get their footing, while they build their foundation, while they build more support, while we build the team. Eventually, we hope to have enough stability here financially and with our workforce here that will allow us to go help other projects internationally. The funding comes entirely from private donations, and those are international, from grants and private donors, foundations, companies, and private donors. We don't get any federal or state funding from the United States or within Brazil. We actually think that those funds should go towards civic projects, especially here in Brazil, where there is the road systems, the school system, the hospital systems, they all need tremendous amount of work, and your tax dollars for Brazilians need to go to those facilities. So we are entirely private donations, and right now about 85% of the funding comes through Global Sanctuary for Elephants, and then we earmark that for development of Elephant Sanctuary Brazil. Over time, we hope for Elephant Sanctuary Brazil, as they develop more of a reputation for being a very transparent, open, and honest organization, that their funding will increase here, and that will allow us to put Global Sanctuary for Elephants funds towards other projects. You talked at the beginning about organizations that didn't use funds properly. It is a huge fear in South America. There's a lot of lack of trust for nonprofits because of improper use of funds. And one of the things that we're keen on is showing that transparency, showing the integrity that with which we operate. And as people are starting to learn more about our organization here in Brazil and have found comfort that a U.S. nonprofit is guiding them through this, that they are starting to support more and more. We're starting to have more companies jump on board. But it is a slow process. Also, we don't have the same culture for charitable giving that we have in the United States. Yeah. So it's going to take some time. But that's over time, it will build. And Brazilians are very proud of what we're doing. And hopefully, they'll continue to support and grow the organization as well.
So, Scott, we have just maybe a minute or so left, sadly. But I want to ask a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
One is, you'd mentioned that there's going to be room at the Brazil Sanctuary for 10 female Asian sort of max. So what is the overall number comfortably of elephants overall that you anticipate you could house at the Brazil Sanctuary?
Just for clarification, right now we are prepared for 10 female Asian based on our development. We will be expanding that facility.
Okay.
We have to build in phases. So what we've done with each phase is an elephant care center, three small enclosures between 1 and 2 acres each, and then two larger enclosures between up to about 20 acres each. I'm sorry, 20 hectares, so 40 acres each.
Okay.
So we have about 75 acres fenced off for Asian elephants right now. We're doing that same first phase development, a very similar concept for Africans. And then we'll do the same thing for males. And then we'll come back and we'll amplify the space as time and money permit. Funding is the critical factor. The faster money comes in, the faster we can build, the faster we can accommodate more elephants. So that is the primary structure.
Sure.
In the end, once it's all done, we will have the capacity for up to 40 or 50 elephants, and possibly even more. I doubt we'll ever reach that number because we're going to have these tragic situations. Like Gita came, she had 2.5 beautiful years, but she passed away before she had a chance to live out the remaining 20 years.
Yeah.
We believe she had a stroke, which ended her life very, very quickly. But that's going to continue to happen with elephants. They're not going to live here forever because of the damage that is done from captivity. But we do want to, we do hope that we can sustain up to 40 or 50 elephants if the need exists.
Great. All right. Well, unfortunately, we have reached the end of our time. Scott, I'm just going to quickly read a quick email that just came in. It says, thank you for this interview, Duncan. We have been a fan of Scott's and Carol Buckley since their Elephant Sanctuary days in Honolulu, Tennessee. They both do amazing, beautiful work in their various respective sanctuaries and organizations and work. And we send our huge thanks. We donate when we can. And this is from Animal Friends in Brooksville, Florida. So that's a nice note on which to end this. So, Scott, we've been speaking with Scott Blaze again, the Global Sanctuary for Elephants, and specifically calling or from Skype speaking about the Elephant Sanctuary Brazil from Brazil. And the website is globalelephants.org. Good luck, Scott, and we will, of course, speak again and get another update when there's inevitably more cool things to talk about on the elephant front. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Duncan. We appreciate it very much. And there's a lot happening here, so people can stay tuned through the website and Facebook and join us on this wonderful journey.
All right. Thanks again, Scott.
Thank you, Duncan.
In a moment, I'll speak with Kelsey Eberle of the Animal Legal Defense Fund about this awful situation with that organization called California Equine Retirement Foundation, or CERF, an ALDF suit that seeks to remove starving and otherwise neglected horses from there. Meanwhile, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner for part of a piece called Farming 101 by Drew Hastings. That's what's happening in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Well, it's probably obvious to most of you that I'm a farmer. That's essentially what I do. I farm. Believe it or not, I have not farmed that long. I've only been a farmer about 2 years. I've been an urban guy my whole life. I lived in New York, Los Angeles, I lived in San Francisco for a while. And you know, I was coming on 50 and I said, you know what, to hell with this. I'm gonna go back to Midwest where I'm from. I'm gonna get myself a farm. You know? Well, I'll be honest. I don't even know how I got a farm. My credit score is 6. I had to use my Speedway points on my financial statement. So I get this farm, and I don't know how many of you here have ever lived rural or in the country, but Jesus, it is creepy out there. If you're not, it is creepy. They'll tell you, at night, sun goes down, pitch black. Did you know that at night, possum walking through a cornfield sounds exactly like 3 men with an axe? Yeah. And what kind of owl makes this sound? You're gonna die. I kid you not, I am not making this up. My place is so far out there, Domino's Pizza will not deliver to me. I've never even heard of anything. Like, I call Domino's now. Oh, we don't come that far. You're gonna have to drive up Newmarket Community Center. Pull in the parking lot, flash your lights. We'll meet you. Like it's a drug deal. Do you have the pizza? Yes, do you have the money? Of course I got the money. Did anyone follow you here? They all drive tractors, for Christ's sakes.
All right, that was Drew Hastings with part of a piece called Farming 101, taken from his album Irked and Miffed. Now let's speak with Kelsey Everly of the Animal Legal Defense Fund about that green situation with the horse organization and ADLDF's lawsuit aiming to improve it. This is Kelsey Everly on Talking Animals on WM. Good morning, Kelsey.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
So if I could ask you to briefly maybe outline what sort of operation the California Equine Retirement Foundation, or CERF, was for many years and the reputation it enjoyed for most of that time.
Yeah, the California Equine Retirement Foundation had a sterling reputation, you know, for caring for retired racehorses. You know, they would come after their racing careers and, you know, live out happy lives at CERF, and CERF, you know, had a reputation for providing them good care. But unfortunately, all of that changed a few years ago when the new director came in and really ran the organization and the horses into the ground.
I was wondering if it was a leadership change or vacuum or donations had dried up. I mean, something obviously was behind this for things to kind of take such a drastic turn. So when did people first notice a problem at CERF?
So it became sort of increasingly apparent. The leadership change happened around 2016. And after that point, the organization stopped applying for the funds that had previously ensured that it could, you know, give the proper care to the horses. And really in 2018, you know, conditions began to deteriorate seriously. And that was when our plaintiffs, United Pegasus Foundation, and others in the community, you know, saw that the horses were starving, saw that CERF, the California Equine Retirement Foundation, was not buying enough hay to feed them, and that's when our plaintiff, you know, Pegasus and others stepped up to try to you know, clean up the mess and prevent horses from suffering and dying.
So as I understand it, Kelsey, then in the late spring and summer, 44 horses were removed. But I guess where the point of contention and therefore the lawsuit comes in is that they are fighting removal of what I guess is about 20 or so remaining horses. Why, if the others were removed, I gather at least without incident, why are they fighting so hard against this remaining 20?
We don't know exactly. One thing that, you know, is a factor is that many of these horses are still owned by, you know, their prior owners, and so Surf had custody of them, but Pegasus was able to basically show, you know, the horse's owners the terrible condition that their horses were in and what Surf had done, and basically get those owners permission to remove them. And we haven't been able to, or Pegasus has not been able to do the same for the remaining 20 to 25 horses, and Surf is refusing, you know, to give them up. And so that's why we're bringing this lawsuit to save the remaining horses from starvation.
I got you. So we're fortunately just at the end of our time here, Kelsey, but where someone sort of interested to track this, is there any place online to kind of see what the status of the suit is, and more to the point, kind of the status of the remaining horses?
Yeah, we will be, you know, updating our website with any news about the horses and about the case. Our website is ALDF.org.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping that we'll be able to share, you know, good news about the remaining horses very soon, and we're working hard to get them out of harm's way on behalf of our plaintiffs.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to fill us in on this. And again, I just thought it was a rough story by itself, but also kind of a cautionary tale given the long time that they've been serving horses, and again, generally the very good reputation they've had, and just how things unfortunately kind of went south and sour. And it's just important to learn from those kinds of things. So thank you for filling us in.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity and his guest, Nitty Gritty Dirtbound founder, Don McEwen. That's extending this three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the new hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with Euro Radio, Paco Morales, and then Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music at 2 p.m. I'll be back next week with the annual Talking Animals Christmas Animal Song Extravaganza right here on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Also invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, our Twitter feed, and more. You can like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram. You can also subscribe to our newsletter. Find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other scintillating news from the Talking Animals headquarters. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond.